You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. Well, welcome back, everybody, to the CPC Together podcast. I'm here with Nico, Rachel, and our most recent teacher, Sandy Hughes. Hello, Sandy.
Hello.
Sandy's got great mic technique, by the way. We were talking about mic technique before we started. She knows how to talk into a mic, Nico.
She does. I think she's been doing this for a while.
Yes.
Yeah. Sandy, you've done, correct me if I'm wrong, a fair amount of like mentoring over the years, right? Like you kind of always have like disciples, people that you take on.
Every now and then, yes, you could say that.
Would you ever consider mentoring Rachel in a very specific specific area of her life, and that is mic technique?
I mentor Rachel in all kinds of ways. So we have a meeting on Wednesday where we're going to go have our breakfast burritos so we can practice that technique.
Maybe we can pretend the burrito is a mic.
It's a mic.
When they say eat the mic, you just eat the burrito. Do.
Yep.
With the special
sauce.
Say.
Don't you say eat the mic.
Yeah, right. That's great. I'm gonna how much do I have to pay to get that on your guys' action item list? I'll give you all the money.
How much should we have them pay for our breakfast?
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah.
What if I give you all the money in my right pocket?
$6.
Do you just like carry cash? I like have no cash.
Brandon carries cash.
Makes a lot of bets.
Because he makes a lot of bets and he gives away a lot of money. He didn't have to pay you for that action item.
It's
you
a already line said item you were in the budget.
He simply offered.
Hold on. You're making it sound like I like have a gambling issue, Nico. I don't go around making a lot of bets. I like to spice up life a little bit.
That's true. Okay, the bets you do make are foolish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not excessive necessarily.
Exactly. Like,
how much will you pay me to do my job up on the whiteboard behind me? That's my question.
Oh, man. Okay, I have a question for you guys. So based on kind of a little bit of what Sandy was talking yesterday, she mentioned the fight or flight response. I'm curious in this room, which of us are fight and which of us are flight? So I'm going to go around. So Rachel, what would you say you are? Fight or flight?
I think I'm a wannabe fight. Like my parents once went out of the house for the night and my sister and I were left home alone. So we grabbed knives from the kitchen.
Yeah.
And hid in the dining room. And we're like, if anyone comes through the door that's not supposed to be there, we'll just go after them. And then my parents come home, they're unlocking the door, and we're like, that's not them. They can't be back so soon, and we just run. We leave the knives, and we run. So I think we're wannabe fight, but definitely flight.
Yeah, that's good. What about you, Nico?
Probably situational.
Okay, let me give you a situation. You are at a movie with your brand new girlfriend. It's only your second date. But it went pretty well. You guys had good, deep conversation before you went to the movie. But bad on you for going to a movie for a second date, because you need conversational dates. But we'll talk about that later. So, okay, you're walking out of the movie.
Conversation happens after the movie.
You're walking through an alleyway because you parked in a place that was more affordable. But you had to walk through a scary alleyway. And suddenly a man jumps out from the dumpster and he says, "Give me all your money, punk." What do you do?
So the correct option is to run and just make sure that I stay between the crazy man that wants her money and my imaginary girlfriend.
Okay, the imaginary girlfriend got away.
Okay. Someone raised that young man, right?
Okay, that's good.
This
is a country song, by the way.
The one that got away.
I would still try to run, because getting into a fight when you don't absolutely have to is how people get hurt and die.
So you're a flight.
When I can, yes. There's another story to back this up.
Well, I think all of us would fight if we had no other choice, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you? You wouldn't, Rachel?
I don't think so. It wouldn't go very far.
Like, if someone started punching you in the face and you couldn't run anywhere, you would try to punch him back, wouldn't you?
I feel like my skills would be better used in trying to block the punches. Because then, Rachel, if I try to punch them, they might just get me back. Oh, I could play dead. But I might start laughing. I can't lie very well.
The ultimate flight response is just plain dead.
There is one story where I was forced to make a very split-second decision, fight or flight. I got pranked by some friends at a dinner. It's very cruel and unusual. My friend had this imaginary box. It said it had something in it. It was probably gum or candy or whatever. I went to open it. It was like a little drawstring. And when you opened it, there was a fake spider on a spring that would jump out of the box onto the back of your hand. I did not try to hit the spider off or anything stoic like that. I yelped. I tried to leap back. I slipped on the kitchen linoleum floor.
Oh my gosh.
I went head over heels onto my back, and I took a fruit basket down to the ground with me. And I forever implanted a memory in my friend's head.
That's like the best reaction that you could hope for in a scary.
Oh my goodness.
Oh.
So yeah, I don't know. I think getting into a fight because the option is there is pretty foolish, even among people that know how to fight. That's considered a terrible idea. So it's pretty situational.
Unless you're Chuck Norris.
I guess. That's true. That's very true, actually. Because if you're Chuck Norris, you can just manipulate the universe.
So the other day, this story that Nico's telling reminds me. I have a hairspray. I only recently decided to buy my own bottle of hairspray. Because at one point, my hair was getting so long. Because Kevin and I's barber moved. And it had gone months without a haircut. And so I was like, I got to tame this mess somehow. And so I bought a bottle of hairspray.
What kind of hairspray?
I don't know. White.
TGI.
It's a white bottle.
Paul Mitchell?
I don't know.
Okay. Sebastian? Did you go into Ulta? That's what I want to know.
No. It's just from Knob Hill.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Yeah. It may have been mayonnaise, but I think it was hairspray. So anyway, I think I left the cap off of it at one point, and someone put the cap back on for me, because when I went to go use it, a spider crawled out of the cap onto my hand. Oh. Look at this thing.
I did not see that photo.
It's like a listeners,
this thing
spider.
Is nasty.
How does it's that got even chunk? Fit?
I flipped out. I went and got the Raid and sprayed it.
And then
tried to flush it down the drain, and it wouldn't go down the drain. It's too fat.
So your response is flight until you can get a hold of chemical weapons and then fight.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. No, I'm a flight. And Katie and I have learned that Katie is a fight and I'm a flight.
Ha ha.
So one time here's Katie's example. So I came home. Well, Katie came home one night. This is like when we were first married. And I decided it would be fun. You know how I love scaring people. Rachel's been scared by me quite a bit. And so I decided it's like nighttime. And she comes home late at night. And so I hide behind like our car in the shadows as she pulls up. And I'm just going to like grab her ankle as she walks by. But I couldn't grab her ankle. So I just decided to run up behind her. So I ran up behind her. And she just turns around and punches me straight in the chest. Like full force, like poof, like that, like knocked the wind out of me.
No.
And I was like, oh, she's like, why did you scare me like that? I had no idea who you were, but she was like ready to tussle.
There you go. Way to go, Katie.
I know.
Get it, girl.
She was brave. On the other hand, me. So we go to this. Have you guys been to those haunted houses that like sometimes Great America will do where they'll create like haunted houses?
Yeah. Can't do those.
So we go through, and the thing that I may have told you guys this story, but the thing that scared me really bad at the time was that movie, The Ring, where it was like a horror movie where the girl comes like out of your TV And then she comes and just like walks at you, but her hair is covering her face. Have you ever seen this?
Yeah. Can't I stay away from horror movies?
Oh, yeah. It's terrifying.
Yeah. I can't hang.
But what happens is you go to sleep and your TV goes what it used to do, like the white snow, the
staticky.
And as soon as that happens, then you're dead because she comes and walks out of the TV and comes and kills you.
That's a classic.
Yeah. So this haunted house was a Ring-themed haunted house. And so we're walking through, and I'm protecting Katie, right? So I'm standing behind her with my arms on her shoulders, kind of steering her through, and if anything happens...
This was after she beat you?
This was before. I think we were dating. Okay. She should have ran for the hills at this point. So we go through. She knows I'm scared because I'm, like, gripping her shoulders. And we go into this one room, and there's nothing. Like, all the rooms have all kinds of, like, visual stimulation. And this room is just, like, an empty white room, which for some reason was so much scarier. And then you look in this one little corner of the room, and you see the lady who comes out of the TV. And she's just crouched in the corner. And she just slowly stands up and then turns and looks at you. That's all she does. Just look. She just turns her head and looks at you. And you can't even see her eyes because her hair is covering. And I flipped out. I ran. But not only did I run, I threw Katie towards the girl. No. And ran out of the haunted house. She was so mad at me.
So funny that we're even talking about this because I almost did that for the opener of my sermon. So in Fremont, there's a group called the Candlelighters who put on a ghost house every year. And it's done at the one of the old carriage houses in Fremont.
Oh, gosh.
And so every year it's a different theme. But they always have Good Witch Glenda who will take the little kids through the ghost house so they're not scared. Well, one year my mom got tapped on the shoulder to be Good Witch Glenda, and she hates scary places. Mm. And so she's like glitzed up with the whole outfit, the whole nine yards. And my brother and I just laughing at my mom because she does not like scary things. She wanted to know every corner someone would be jumping out. She's all, Good Witch Glenda is here, you know. To guide you through the ghost house.
Imagine you're like knocking over kids to get out of there.
I know. It was pretty funny.
Sandy, what are you, fight or flight?
You know, it depends on the situation. I've been known to pack a punch or two. Mm-hmm. And I've been known to get out of there really fast.
So you're kind of like Nico in that way.
Yeah, I've risen to the occasion in a fight, but I grew up on a street of all boys, so...
That'll do it.
That was in my much younger days. But you can ask McCollum. I thought someone was in my house. One day I came home to my front door totally wide open. I'd just gotten back from Mike and Linda's house, and I'm pulling in the garage. I'm going up my stairs. The front door is wide open. The house is pitch black. Aww. No one's there. I'm like... I run back down the stairs. I get in my car, and I'm like sitting outside my car in front of the garage waiting to hit anyone who's like in my house stealing something. So I call Mike and I said, Mike, my front door is wide open. I think someone's in my house. So he came over and he looked at every room, every closet.
Oh my gosh.
To make sure no one was hiding in the house.
Wow.
Is there anybody there?
No.
Oh. Do you think the door got left open?
No, I had some friends over and they didn't quite latch it, and the wind, because the Redwood Shores winds can be pretty, and it blew it open.
Yikes.
But I ran out of there really fast. Yeah.
That's always pretty scary when you're sitting in a room and then like the wind opens the door.
Yeah. Closet doors at night.
Raccoons outside the window when you're trying to fall asleep.
Oh, man, there's these coyotes in Redwood Shores.
Yes. Oh, I got one. I got another flight one.
Yeah, tell me.
Okay, so I am out with Darcy and Maui over where the Denolises live.
Maui is a puppy.
Yeah, Maui's a puppy. Way. And I'm learning to fly the drone. So on Sunday when I was flying it, I wouldn't crash it into people. Maui's off leash. She's running around. I'm flying the drone, What comes out of the thicket of bushes? The humongous coyote.
Could just bite Maui in half.
Who was probably waiting for lunch or dinner. Mm. And I said, Darcy, get that dog!
Oh, no!
Get out of here!
Oh, my gosh. Yikes. Yeah, they're crazy, man. And they come past... We live right on the Bay Trail. And they come past our house like at 2 a.m. And they make the craziest noises, like right outside our window.
Have you seen that Next Door post where like someone videoed all five of them just like running and playing? And it's actually really cute looking, but
no,
also very scary.
It's terrifying at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that much.
That one of those coyotes has been in my complex, that's for sure.
Yikes.
So.
Oh, man. Well, so, Sandy...
So how are you going to transition this one, Brandon?
We never know.
Five coyotes, 600 men.
I always hope that Nico works his brilliance in the editing. Let me just trust him. But yeah, 600 men to arrest Jesus.
I know.
That's crazy. So we're going through the story. You took us through the story of Jesus the night that he got arrested. So what was the, why so many people for one man? Would that have been a normal thing?
Well, that's the question Jesus asks. Really? Mm. You know, I don't think that would have been a normal thing. But, you know, there's all kinds of controversy around Jesus' arrest anyways. Mm. You know, and you can look at all the historical documents on that and the commentators and whatnot. But... I mean, yeah, they thought for sure he was a major problem.
Hmm. Wow.
And he says, was I leading a rebellion? Hmm. And, you know, to him, he doesn't see himself as leading a rebellion, but that's, I mean, they kind of did view it that way, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what
did.
The religious leaders would have seen and probably told the Roman leaders.
Yeah. Hmm.
To put that number into context, how many people do we typically have in the auditorium on a single Sunday service?
Well, 9 a.m. we run about 350 and 11 about 250.
Wow. Okay. So double, almost double the amount of people in our church service came.
Yeah.
Wow. If you think about it, that's like 600 witnesses to what happens right there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Mm. So yeah, you kind of hone in on the betrayal thing with Judas and, you know, hopefully not betrayal. Hopefully we don't know betrayal on this level, but I think all of us understand a bit of what betrayal. And I love the story that you told of junior high. So Judas betrays him with a kiss, and the way that they describe the kiss, it's like a fervent, passionate, like it's meant to, it's a real thing.
Yeah.
But also like in the most betraying way.
Yeah.
And then you use this quote that I just thought was really good. Well, actually from Proverbs, the wounds from a friend can be trusted, but your enemy multiplies kisses. And I'm just curious if you've ever had, or anyone, any of you other guys have ever had moments when maybe someone that you do love and trust had to try to, you know, so to speak, wound you, or had to maybe tell you something you didn't want to hear, or anything like that.
I could say a lot. I've had some really great friends in my life who have who I love dearly, and I know that they have the best intentions for me, who have pointed things out in a kind but loving way.
Even if it's but kind, it hurts you to don't hear. Want to hear it.
Yeah.
You're not always ready to hear that kind of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. But usually after it's said and done and you think about it and yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That, yeah. You know?
Mm. Rachel's about to say something. No. I had this the other night, so occasionally at dinner, much to my family's chagrin, I will give a question prompt. And they all kind of roll their eyes like, oh my gosh, what deep thing is Dad going to try to get us to talk about? And so the other night, this was a couple nights ago, maybe it was actually Sunday night, because maybe I was thinking about this, but I asked, I asked us to go around the table, and then we were going to reverse it. So each one had to talk about the person to their left, and then we were going to come back around.
What is one area
that the person to your left could alter or change to help them thrive better?
That's a good question. I'm gonna have to use that next time I'm sitting around Phil's with the boys. I might have to pull that one out.
Do it. I want to hear. But they weren't so keen on playing.
Yeah.
Especially Charlie didn't like it. Because Charlie happened to be sitting to Olivia's left.
Oh, there we go.
And actually, Olivia was super insightful with what she said, but you know, Charlie wasn't ready to hear it. She was like, I didn't sign up for this game.
Right. Oh, Charlie.
But I think it's so poignant. It's so true.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that happen, Nico? Someone tells you something that cares about you?
Not in recent memory. I'd be surprised if it hasn't happened, but I can't think of a story that I can actually remember to use as an example, which is a little bit distressing because then I do start to wonder whether or not I've ever received that kind of feedback. I mean, from someone other than like you, but that's always been more as my boss than...
I was going to say, just hang around CPC long enough, Nico. Uh-huh, you'll get it. Uh-huh.
What do you call it, Sandy? The velvet hammer?
The velvet hammer. Yeah, the velvet hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned the velvet hammer from John Brandon.
Yeah.
Aww.
Yeah. Sandy's good at the velvet hammer. Okay, well, that's kind of a flop of a question. So here's another thought to ask you guys. So Sandy, you also mentioned that, so when Peter was kind of stepping up and, you know, and I know he wasn't in this passage specifically named, but he was in other passages where Peter chops the ear off, right?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Describe this, the scene a little bit.
Well, we've got a disciple who has been from the beginning very boisterous about how much he would never deny Jesus. He would die for Jesus. He would do it better than the rest of the disciples almost. Mm. And here he sees 600 men coming to arrest Jesus. And in the heat of the moment, we all know Peter's kind of the hot-headed guy who often, you know, doesn't think before he speaks. And I think his actions are kind of the same way. He did something before he thought about it in the heat of the moment. And he pulls out that sword and he's a fisherman. What does he know about sword fighting? And the running joke in the commentaries I was reading was like, he totally missed the guy. He hit his ear instead. You know? But I think in the scheme of things, he thought he was fighting an earthly battle to save Jesus. Still not understanding what Jesus was just about to go do. And he's thinking about protecting him more than anything. Because you know what? He said, I would die for you, Jesus. Not realizing Jesus is actually going to die for him.
What was Jesus' response to when Peter did that? Did he have one?
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, part of it was, what do you think? I'm here leading a rebellion. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of puts a stop to it. And we find out more in Luke, Jesus heals Malchus's ear right away. You know, just, it's almost like, stop it, everybody. Mm-hmm. You know. John records something about all, when asking if he was Jesus of Nazareth, John records when Jesus says, I am he, like all 600 guards fall down. Mm-hmm. So... but I was in the Gospel of Mark, so I did not go there. Yeah. So don't ask me any questions on that.
I tend to respect Peter a lot for sticking to his guns, even though they were always the wrong guns. Yeah. Basically up until the end.
Yeah. But what I love is that, you know, he is sticking to his guns in a lot of ways, Nico. You're right. And quite frankly, we know what happens to Peter, even though he fails miserably. God is going to end up using him in massive ways to spread the good news, to spread who Jesus is, to be the corners, the rock of the church, basically, you know. And so even in the midst, I know we kind of often give Peter a bad rap, but there's this transformation that takes place in him between the time this happens and, you know, the end of the different gospels. And then you look at him in Acts 3 and he gives this passionate speech about who Jesus is and what he's done. And you're like, holy cow. In a matter of a few weeks, you know, this transformation takes place. So
you said Peter thought he was fighting an earthly battle. In reality, it was a spiritual one.
Yeah.
Do you think that this applies to us today in some way?
Yeah. I didn't go there that much in my sermon, mostly for time. But, you know, there's a lot in that passage, you know, with everyone coming in the dark of night, you know. A lot of sin happens in the dark of night. A lot of spiritual battles, I think, happen in the dark of night. And as Jesus was preparing for the spiritual battle in Gethsemane when he was praying, he knew exactly what this meant. He was going to be separated from his Father for time being. So there's a spiritual battle that Jesus fully knows. But again, I don't think the disciples get that yet.
Well, like you said, he was going to try to wake them up. You know, they were sleeping. He's like, how are you guys sleeping right now?
Exactly.
And Jesus is curiously not fighting physically.
Right. Exactly.
When they come and confront him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that had to be such a mystery to Peter. Yeah. But we can see it. And Jesus was fighting the spiritual battle. Yeah, it's crazy to think
about. And I think, too, I mean, you know, we fight a lot of things. And I'm not so sure. I think sometimes we give too much credit to Satan. But then sometimes I think we don't really see the spiritual battle like Peter didn't see it either.
Yeah.
You know, it may be in hindsight we see it. Oh.
It's almost certainly a lot more common to misread the situation like Peter than to correctly assume that we or someone else is being treated like Job.
Yeah. Yeah.
This just popped into my head, but it's a testament to this young man that is producing our podcast. we had a really hard situation here, I don't know, a year and a half ago or so at church, and I won't go into the details of what the situation at all was, but it all culminated on a Sunday morning, which is already pretty stressful for us. And everything was going down. Everybody had kind of their own reaction to what was happening. And I go and I look at Nico, and he's back in the back row praying. And I was like, dude, that's awesome. Like, think about, you know, that means that, you know, where your trust is in those moments. And I think so often, like me in that moment, like I was thinking through my own tools, what tools I had available to me and what physical things I needed to solve or fight here in that moment. And it really wasn't a time for that. It was much more of a time to pray.
Yeah. Well, that makes me think back to earlier in the Gospel of Mark when we were talking about how the means we use matter. Like, we can't see or desire the kingdom of God and chase after it with human means, because then that's not chasing the real end in itself. It's chasing our own kingdom.
That hits incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, that time you mentioned is one of the only times in recent memory where I think I properly utilized prayer.
And I've just been... I believed you did that all the time.
I have desperately been trying to integrate it more, but it's really hard. When you have what you think are the appropriate earthly tools to fix a problem, you go to what you know. And most of the time, what I know is more destructive than helpful. But my first instinct is 99.9% of the time is not, let's see what God has to say about this. And let's like really lean on him.
Well, it's funny you even say you go to what you know. What did Peter do right after he denied Jesus three times?
You tell us.
He went back to being a fisherman.
That's right, because that's where Jesus finds him.
Wow.
You go back to what you know. And that's what Peter did too.
Wow. Can you imagine that after the 3-year journey?
Yeah.
You're like, well, I guess I'll
Get the nets out.
Oh man. Yeah, that's crazy to think about. All right, Sandy, I want to switch gears here a second.
Okay.
Because I've been around the Bible a lot.
Oh boy.
Oh Lord.
But
you want to go to where the streaker was, huh?
I don't remember the naked man.
You know how many comments I got in the courtyard? I don't ever remember the naked man.
Was this almost in the King James translation?
I have almost certainly heard that story before in junior high.
That's right.
And I still did not remember it being there.
Yeah. Nico probably went through the seriously ridiculous sermon series we did in junior high where we just pulled out all these crazy Bible stories. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them.
Oh, wow.
This
and
is the guy.
If I did remember it, it was probably like a fever dream. Like, oh, I guess that did happen. But
But think about David. He ran naked through the streets praising God.
Yeah.
He did.
You got Ezra, who God called him to bury his underwear, so he was naked for a time. There's some nakedness going on. You got Adam and Eve, of course.
The OG.
We could do a whole underwear series.
We could.
Adam and Eve's with like the fig leaves, you know. BVDs with this guy.
Anyways, so go on. What's your question about underwear. The naked guy?
So what you said that this that you think, and I know there's you know some speculation on this and all that kind of stuff, but that you'd read some scholars talk about this, and you think this is actually Mark's signature on the whole story. So how is that? Explain that a little bit more.
No, that's a great question, and I don't know if I have great answers for it. But, you know, I even asked this to Dan and Kevin one day in a lead team meeting or a worship meeting. I can't remember what meeting it was. And they're like, well, what do the scholars say? But, yeah, most of the scholars I read really thought that this was Mark just kind of signing his name to this story. Really, I was there. I saw this. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that happen in the Gospel of Mark where there's unnamed people like the rich young ruler, like the house where the Last Supper is happening. You know, some people say, or some scholars say, even that house is owned by Mark's mother, who was a wealthy woman and was known to give financially to Jesus's mission. And so there's this piece of Mark was there at the Last Supper thought, you know. And so he probably sees these guys go out and he wants to see what's going on too because he's a curious young teenager.
I think it's brilliant.
Tell us more, Nico.
Yeah, unpack that thought for us.
Just as a writing style in general... It explains where that story in Mark stops.
Yeah.
Because Mark got out of there.
Right.
And the idea that Mark would feel it important to add that to the end of such an important story if it was just some random guy is unlikely.
And the detail that he writes about what happens with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane in the sense of he's praying so much, you know, he's dripping blood. You know, some of these, like, really sharp details, it's interesting, you know?
And his omission of of names is like, you said he didn't name Peter.
Mm-hmm. Or the rest of the disciples.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Because they weren't acting like Jesus's disciples. Mm. You know, they weren't acting like what they had been trained to be and do. Mm. Mm.
This would be, I was just thinking about this, like not knowing the hope of what was about to happen, which pretty much they didn't. None of them really had hope that Jesus was going to come back to life, I think.
I think they really had hope that Jesus was going to conquer the Romans.
Yeah. And
they wouldn't be oppressed by the Romans anymore. Mm.
So if you think about them in this moment, not only is it scary and they scatter, but like you're kind of seeing like a dissolving of a movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like up to this point, this movement had so much momentum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like wowing people, and everyone who meets Jesus is blown away by him, including religious leaders. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like this big, huge upward trajectory. And then at the moment when we see, is it really going to take?
Yeah.
That's when it just seems as though, oh, they arrested him and now they're going to kill him. And all his followers go away. Like, that's just like, it's got to be. This has got to be one of the saddest moments besides him actually dying.
If Mark was a book series, that would be the most criticized cliffhanger of all time. That's my thought, is we have the benefit of knowing what lies ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't.
They didn't.
And if it was being written as like a series, the readers wouldn't.
Yeah.
So, Sandy, there's a lot of people in this story that we could potentially identify with. The streaker.
Hopefully not. No, but.
But one that I did not expect, mm-hmm. that I've never really heard anyone say, I kind of identify with him, is Judas.
Yeah.
So maybe talk through these three different, you said, you know, where do you find yourself in the story? Judas, Peter, and some of the other unnamed disciples. Talk us through those three.
Yeah. Well, no one wants to say, oh, I totally relate to Judas. I mean, come on. The guy betrayed Jesus for money.
Mm.
But the reality is we can never think that we could not do something horrible like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
We are sinners in need of a savior, and you'd like to think you wouldn't sink so low, but that's a problem if you don't think you could.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, Judas, like I said in the sermon, he was known to dip his hand in the coffer and steal money, and obviously he's betraying Jesus for money. And so there's this secret sin. And you know, I think if we're all honest with one another, we've all had secret sin in our life, right? And that's why I just really wanted to encourage people, you know, that's the part we can all relate to when it comes to Judas. It may not be betraying someone for money and then they go get killed.
Yeah.
But the reality is we've all got sin that we don't want anyone to know about, right? And this is the opportunity. And we saw this, you know, at the Last Supper, where, you know, Jesus kind of gave an opportunity for Judas to come forward and say, that's me. I mean, he really kind of...
When he said, like, one of you here will betray me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was almost this opportunity for Judas to make a U-turn, you know?
It's kind of like making a U-turn in the middle of 101 rush hour traffic.
Right, exactly.
I cannot fault Judas for not coming forward in that moment.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, but the thing is that the reality is Jesus already knows about those things in our own lives.
It's not so secret.
It's not so secret. And we may feel shame because of it. But the reality is Jesus wants us to lay that load on him because he stood alone so we didn't have to. And he's offering forgiveness and transformation and redemption in exchange for it. And I just think that, like I said, we give Judas a bad rap, but the reality is any of us could have been Judas.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the secret nature of sin and what in your pastoral experience has made that so damaging. Like, what is it about a sin being in secret that makes it?
I think the biggest thing that I see in my time being a pastor is most people don't realize the damage it's going to cause to a lot of other people.
The ripple effects.
The ripple effects. I mean, we unfortunately we see this all the time in church and news, church news and celebrity pastors, and none of them think that they could fall to what we're talking about here. None of us would probably say that we could fall to that. But the ripple effects that I've seen, the damage it causes to friends or families or children or ministries or businesses, you know, it changes things forever.
I think in the dark also sin has more power. You know, when there's like something that's secret that nobody knows about but you, it has this kind of secret grip on you. And your biggest fear becomes if anyone would ever know that.
Right.
And start couch it in shame. And,
right.
And it really becomes bigger than it would ever be if you were able to out it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you were able to tell somebody, look, this is what I'm dealing with. It would sort of lose an element of its power, I think.
Yeah.
Well, imagine the anxiety of never, of like always wondering if people are going to find out about it or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exhausting.
So Judas is the hard one.
Yeah.
Peter, you know, Peter too, you know, here's Jesus's right-hand man, really. And I can't blame him either. I mean, how many of us have fallen asleep praying?
This morning.
You know, exactly, this morning. You know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That is so true. But to be, I think, I can relate to Peter in that way, in the sense of, okay, Lord, yeah, sure. You know.
I think a lot of people would like to identify with Peter. Everybody wants to be that zealous for Jesus.
Right, exactly.
Even to the point of accepting the consequences of, well, you'd betray him three times and generally be seen as a bit of a blockhead.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I don't know. You can't blame him. You kind of want to be him, but not really. And
you want to be him in the good moments.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Which are few and far
between. You don't want to be him when they're lopping off someone's ear.
Yeah. Or desperately trying to explain how disconnected I am from Jesus around a fire.
Right. Right.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the third one.
The unnamed disciples, you know. They all said they pledged to die with him, you know, just in that previous passage. And guess what? We'll die with you, Jesus. But yet they all end up deserting. You know, I always feel like we always give Peter the worst rap, Peter and Judas the worst rap, because they're mentioned, you know. But they all fled. All 12 of them.
Peter at least tried to do something.
Right. Yeah. You know, and James and John, you know, the sons of thunder who want to sit at the right hand of Jesus are gone. So, again, I was pretty straightforward just in my natural response oftentimes is to run in hard things because... who wants to step into hard stuff? And it's painful, and it reflects your own. I'm looking at you all as you're staring off into thinking about your own pain that, you know, because it's hard.
Yeah.
You know what's fascinating about this, just thinking through, I think you may have mentioned this a little bit, Sandy, before we pressed record, but just thinking about Jesus and his response. So like, what would our response be? What is our response usually when we encounter people that we think have any chance of betraying us? We're going to withhold ourselves.
Right.
We're going to protect ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're going to draw lots of boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Self-preservation.
Yeah. And Jesus knows.
Yeah.
Not just Judas, but all of them.
Yeah.
And I just imagine that, knowing that heartbreak of those that you have been sharing every aspect of your life in ministry with for 3 years, knowing that there's going to be a day when you are standing alone.
Yeah.
And how Jesus, that didn't stop him from drawing all them closer.
No. And it doesn't stop him from pouring into them, teaching them, because the reality is he knows what's even going to happen after that.
It gets worse.
It gets worse, but he knows how they're going to actually stand. Mm-hmm. And they're eventually going to die for their faith in Jesus.
He sees the future. Wow, that's so beautiful.
But he sees what's going to happen next and how all those men are going to spread the kingdom, spread the good news that we're sitting here 2,000 years later talking about it.
Mm-hmm. So he knows the betrayal is, and for most of them, temporary.
Yeah. But still hurtful. Mm. Let's just be honest. Still hurtful.
Yeah. I mean, it would hurt Jesus as much as it would hurt any man.
Yeah. You know.
So what are we left with, Sandy, when we experience, you said we're all going to experience our version of Gethsemane.
Yeah. I think Kevin would call it the dark night of the soul. Mm.
So what do we do?
Well, I went back to what Jesus told his disciples to do in verse 38, to watch and pray. You know, when you're walking with people in the darkest times, you've got to help people see those glimmers of hope. You've got to help see what God is doing in the midst of the fog and the darkness. And that's not always an easy thing to do. And I think God gives us all kinds of things, but we're not always watching. Mm. And then the big one is praying. I mean, we talk about prayer so much. Prayer is super powerful. We all know that. But it's also this piece of getting prayed up almost. Mm. You know, we prepare ourselves to go on a marathon. Right? Yeah. We train ourselves. We train our bodies. We eat right. We sleep right. Well, the same thing is we've got to be prayed up for the spiritual battles we fight, you know? Mm-hmm. And that means taking our time to be with the Lord.